Welcome to Real Thought Leaders, featuring your host, Mindy Gibbons Klein, international speaker, best-selling author, award-winning entrepreneur, and founder of three multinational businesses, the book Midwife, Panoma Press, and Real Thought Leaders. Mindy helps experts become published authors and thought leaders, sharing their wisdom with the world. Mindy's guests will be sharing their biggest, boldest ideas on a range of fascinating subjects, all aimed to improve people's lives and businesses. And now, here's your host, Mindy Gibbons Klein.
Hello, hello. I'm so delighted to be here today and have as my guest someone who I've known for a number of years, a real thought leader, expert in his space. It's Chris Merrington. Chris runs Spring 8020, a training consultancy specializing in working with sales teams and agencies to give them an unfair competitive advantage. He's worked with sales teams in Sky Media and over 90 advertising and PR agencies in the UK and across Europe. Chris is the author of Why Do Smart People Make Such Stupid Mistakes?, a book specifically written for agencies and sales teams to improve their negotiation effectiveness. Chris helps his clients avoid the most expensive mistakes and improve profitability and revenue, some things that are very important to all business people and entrepreneurs. Welcome, Chris.
Good afternoon, Mindy. Lovely to be here.
Good. I'm so glad to have you. I have always been impressed with your knowledge on profitability and revenue, but specifically negotiating so that you get a better profitability and revenue. Many people aren't that great at negotiating. And I had an experience today, in fact, where I was on the phone and I just said, did you get my email? And we have to agree on this fee before I come and do a piece of work for you. So we got into the discussion. I was very confident. And they were looking to offer me 17% of my normal fee. Not 17% discount, 17%. So it was a huge gap. And I aimed to do my best. I tried to remember all of the things you taught me. Well, they're thinking about it at the moment, which is good. It's not a no, but I don't know. Do you see things like that happening all the time, Chris?
I see that a lot. I think clients will typically, whatever your fee is, they're going to tell you that it's expensive. You know, even if it was £30 a day, they'll tell you, oh, that's quite a lot. It's just a natural reaction of clients to want to put pressure on you in terms of your pricing, put you on the back foot. So yeah. You have to be really careful. And I think it's about anticipating what are they likely to say and then thinking, so how am I going to respond to that?
Yeah, well, I had thought about that because we had the call set up for a few weeks. And still, they have a number of other speakers they're using, and apparently everyone else is accepting this very low fee. So I wasn't happy about that. It was just a really interesting showcase of exactly what you speak about and what you've been talking about and writing about for years. At this point, I think it's probably not going to come off, and I'll walk away. And I went on to social media, and I got a whole lot of support for that, standing my ground. You know, really not dropping my trousers, as we say over here. So, you know, it's very vivid in my mind today, that topic.
Yeah. I think it's a real danger because price is the number one factor that will drive the profitability of any business. And you have to get your pricing right. And it's such an easy mistake to drop your price because it starts setting precedents. And actually, if the client, especially such a drop, Mindy, as you're saying, 83%, if my maths is right, an 83% reduction in your fee, if you said, oh, okay, then, I think it sends out all the wrong messages. It basically says that you're a bit like DFS, the furniture store. You never sell at your full price.
Yeah, well, you know, as I say, it's very fresh and very raw today, but I did calm down and I thought, you know, a lot of business people are probably thinking, oh, but I want that piece of business. And there are people who are accepting business for, you know, not what they should be paid. So you're working with professionals, service firms, and agencies, of course, where for the most part, what they're doing is service-based. So can we assume that the profit is intrinsically high anyway, or should we not assume that?
I don't think you can assume that. And strangely enough, I've just had a meeting with an old colleague of mine who's just starting out in consultancy, and he was talking about, in terms of training, and he was talking about what I think was a very low fee. And the trouble is, when you're desperate for business, you think it's about setting a low fee. And I think the danger of that is that it suggests to your client that actually you're not very good. Because price says a lot about how good we are. Now, we have to be good, but also the danger is that if we pitch our fee too low, it sends out messages of either desperation or we're just not very good.
Well, basically, we don't want to immediately go into that conversation about price anyway. So why don't you tell the listeners, besides pricing, what else should people be talking about? What else is important in negotiations?
Planning and preparation is crucial. Just stopping and thinking. And I think the world that we all live in is running so fast, and we run from meeting to meeting, from project to project. And what we don't do too often is give ourselves time to stop and think and plan and anticipate, so that before you go off to a meeting or a telephone conversation with a client, you actually stop and think, what are they likely to throw at me? And there's probably 2-3 typical things that they're likely to talk about. One, how can you possibly justify that fee? What's special about you? Why should I do business with you? What experience have you got? Just kind of classic questions, and just think, so what am I going to say to each of those classic questions? And once you've done that bit of preparation, you can keep reusing that over and over again. So I think preparation is a crucial one. The second thing I think about is not understanding the value that you create for your clients. What do I mean by that? What is the product of the product? How does my client benefit from what it is that I do? In that I do workshops, I do speaking at conferences, and I don't think really clients want to buy workshops. What they want to buy is the result of the workshop. Right. So that might be that their people are more confident, they're better able to have great conversations with their customers and clients. So that's why I call it's the product of the product. It's what is the change in behavior that we can help our clients achieve.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
I've got a couple more.
Another? Yeah. Well, we could go on forever, but I do want to ask you a few other things, unless there was a really, really important one.
I want to do one more, about one more, which is talking to the right person.
Oh, yeah.
It's talking to what I call the decision maker. It is ever so easy, and I've had it happen to me on so many occasions. I find myself talking to what I call a messenger. And what do I mean by a messenger? Somebody who doesn't have the money and the authority to say yes. They have to go off to their boss. And you have to be really careful how you make sure that you qualify, that you're talking to the right person that can actually book you for whatever it is that you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And they are not in a position to negotiate or decide on anything or purchase anything. So what is the point? Because you'll just have to repeat yourself, or it might get lost in translation if they try.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, so what other mistakes have you seen business owners and business leaders make in the area of negotiation?
I think being seen as a commodity, and they see themselves as a commodity. So if you think that you're just the same as everybody else in your sector, why should I pay more? And the more you behave like a commodity and describe yourself like a commodity, then people are going to buy you on trust. Also, they're going to buy you on price. Whereas I think what we need to do is make sure that we're bought because of our specialism, because of our expertise, so that we can have a peer-to-peer relationship with our customers and our clients.
Yeah, well, that's, as you know, at the heart of real thought leadership is making sure that you're seen as the true thought leader in your space. And then you're not a commodity. You hardly could be compared to anyone else. You're in a category of one. So they can't say every other X charges this. They can't compare you easily. That's, I think, one of the benefits of working on your thought leadership, working to raise your profile, but not for the sake of it, just making sure that value really comes across. And you know, all your biggest and boldest and best ideas. So if we focus on that for a moment, I normally wait till later to ask this question, but as I've brought it up myself, tell the listeners a big, bold idea that you have had that perhaps you've started implementing or not yet, something that, that really could shake things up in business.
I don't know whether it answers that specific question, but I think the boldest and most important decision in the 12, 13 years that I've been running my own business was writing my book. And, you know, obviously, Mindy, you know an awful lot of, a lot about that. I think it was a big step because it's a huge investment of time and effort and commitment. But in hindsight now, I kind of think it was probably one of the most, probably the most important step in my business over the past 12, 13 years. Because I think what it does, it, it helps you clarify your own thinking on your subject matter. Mm. And the second thing it does is it demonstrates to your clients that you have expertise and credibility and that you stand out from the crowd, assuming that your book is, has got some good content in it.
Yeah, and yours does. Another plug for why do smart people make such stupid mistakes? And that was quite bold, actually, Chris, to give it that title, because as you know, we don't always come up with the title first. In fact, we rarely do. And that came quite a bit after the major planning and writing had taken place. And when you put a title like that into the market, it's a bit, ooh, you know, are you saying that people are stupid? No, but they do make stupid mistakes. And I think everybody can recognize themselves in that. And that kind of shocking title, as well as the color scheme that we've used, I think has, it's been really popular. And I think you have an Indian edition and possibly some other editions, a Malaysian edition. So, you know, obviously it's becoming very popular around the world as well. And people can relate.
I think the original title was going to be Negotiating with Clients. And I look back on that and think, what a boring title. Because I don't know how many other negotiation books there are that might be something along those lines. And it's therefore about having standout. It is, I guess it is a long title, but I think it's one that piques people's curiosity. It's it is odd, and people kind of smile and they go, oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to be disruptive and kind of shake things up a bit, especially now, especially every business sector seems to be so crowded. Certainly the agency sector, you know, you've worked with 90 of them, but many of them compete with each other, I imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I've been in a room with Chris, and I've seen people from lots and lots of different agencies all sitting in the same room, which I think that's stunning that you've been able to do that.
Well, if you take PR agencies, I've probably worked with 25 at least. And the lovely thing is that quite often they recommend me to other PR agencies. So I think they recognize that in some ways, are they in competition? Yes, but actually, I think it's more about how they raise their game, how they become better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, there should be enough business for everyone. This theme has come up several times on the show. And you know, I'm not one of these people who subscribes to the scarcity model. I think people in business, if they work hard and they do the right things and they listen to mentors, they should be able to create a business for themselves. There is enough business for everybody. It's when they make stupid mistakes, like not listening or like doing the same thing over and over that isn't working, or, you know, being desperate and accepting a piece of work at a much lower rate than you meant to, then they get into trouble. But if we talk about some positive things for a moment. Mm-hmm. Do you have some top tips for businesses who are trying to improve their profitability? So specifically, you know, they're winning business, but they want to end up with a better profit.
Absolutely. The first one is about be clear on your differentiation. What's special about you? And I think when I think back to when I first started my business, I was trying to be everything to everybody. So if you wanted a workshop, if you wanted somebody to speak at a conference, name the topic and I'll do it. And in hindsight, you just become a jack of all trades. And I think clients are looking for specialists. They want the best expertise in a particular area. And I've found over the past 7-8 years, the more that I've niched, then the more successful my business has been. And I think what happens is when you specialize, you become more and more a master of your particular topic. Does that mean you might miss out on some business? Yes, but I think it generates more business because you become the go-to person, as in being a thought leader, as in being the specialist in that topic. So the first thing I'd say is be clear on your differentiation. What makes you special and different? Why should clients come to you? The second thing about profitability that I would encourage your listeners to do is to look at your client base in terms of pricing and profitability and resolve your, what I call the profit vampires. There's a very major top three management consultancy, and reputedly they cull their bottom 5% of clients each year. And I think sometimes we end up with clients that we've had for 4 or 5 years, and you look at them and you think, I'm probably losing money on this client because I haven't been able to increase my fees or my rates with them. And I think it's about being brave, but obviously do that when your business is on the upturn. So as your business grows and you become more successful, that's a good time to cull those customers and clients that are unprofitable. And the third, my third suggestion to businesses to improve their profitability, sorry, but I'm going to come back to pricing, is think about your pricing. Ideally, increase your pricing on a regular basis. When I say regular, minimum once a year, absolute minimum once a year, and increase it. There are a couple of times particularly to increase pricing. One, when you're really busy is a great time to increase your price. And secondly, when the economy is picking up, and it's certainly the economy, I think, is picking up. I see a lot more confidence amongst clients. There are budgets out there. This is a great time to increase your prices. And I would really encourage your listeners, this increase your prices in 2014. This is the year to do it.
Oh, well, if anybody's listening to the recording and it's after 2014, you're still allowed to do it. Well, not just this year, right, Chris?
Absolutely. Well, hopefully 2015 is going to be a good year as well.
Oh,
so,
and every year after that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. thanks for those tips. And I'm sure there's lots more where that comes from. All of Chris's contact details will be available on the website. And I'm sure people can find him online, Chris Merrington, or look up the book, Why Do Smart People Make Such Stupid Mistakes? But right now, I just wanted to touch on something which I don't know if you will be wanting to answer, but you help people negotiate primarily to win a piece of business. But what about the business owners and entrepreneurs that are listening to us that would also like to negotiate with suppliers when they're buying a product or service? Do you have advice on that side of things?
Absolutely, because it's not just what you're selling it at, it's also what you're buying it for. So think carefully about how you negotiate with suppliers. I think a mistake that some businesses get into is that they think it's all about beating up suppliers and beating down their price. Mm-hmm. And that might be okay if it's a one-off purchase. But actually, if this is a supplier that you want to work with long-term, I think that could be short-sighted. And I would encourage you, therefore, with suppliers that you see really more as partners, that you play fair with them. So, for example, those businesses and suppliers that I work with that I see as my ongoing partners, I want to be fair with them on price. I typically will pay their bill within a couple of days of receiving their invoice. It may well be that I don't get paid by my client for a month or 2 months, but I want them to recognize that I care about them. And I think just paying somebody as soon as you receive the invoice is probably quite surprising for a lot of them. But I want to play fair because I think then they'll play fair with me.
Yeah, and it's karma as well. It's, you know, you're putting this into the business universe. And I don't know, we've talked about some woo-woo subjects on the show, but But there's something to be said for the energy that you're putting into business and the world in general, you know?
If I can just talk for a moment about, there are some big corporates out there, I won't mention their names, big corporates out there who are now paying suppliers, many of them on 90 days, some are going to 120 and more. And these are big high street retailers. These are the big corporates in FMCG are paying suppliers on 120 days, which I personally, I think is outrageous.
So do I, but we're circling back to the original point. If you are the person selling into that business and you're having a meeting and you've done all your planning and it's not all about price, but when you get to the terms and conditions, they say, well, our policy is 90 days or 120 days, what would you suggest to the person selling into that organization?
It comes down to never being afraid to walk away from a customer. If you have a customer that is, let's say, 40%, 50%, 60% of your business, the one word you can't say to them is no. Mm. And therefore, my recommendation is that no client is bigger than about 10 to 15% of your business, so that emotionally you can walk away from them. And that gives you psychologically more confidence. I come across too many businesses that are over-dependent on one or two clients and customers, and they're terrified. And they that means you just accept whatever the client tells you. And you mentioned a couple of my corporate clients where I insisted that they paid me on 30 days, and they tried to beat down my price and said no. Is that easy? No, it's really hard, because you think, I want that corporate client on my client list, but at what price?
At what price, indeed. That is such valuable advice. It's, you know, the bit about not letting any particular client represent more than 10 to 15% of your income or profit. That's a situation that can creep up on you. Trust me,
very
over the 12
easily.
Years I've been doing this.
And do you know what, Mindy? It happened to me in probably the first 2-3 years. I had one client that gave me more and more business, which is, I think, a classic trap that I'm sure some of your listeners may have fallen into. And they went to about 70% of my business, and you think, hey, this is fantastic. And then they stopped. Mm. And I remember at the time thinking, oh my goodness, I had very little in the pipeline. And so one of the things I promised myself was I would never become over-dependent on any client, which is where the 10 to 15% comes from. I've worked with accountancy firms and also with some venture capitalists. And when they're looking to buy a company, one of the things they look at is over-dependence. And they, both the accountants and venture capitalists, don't want, if they're buying a company, they don't want it to have more than about 10 to 15% with any particular customer or client, because it is an over-dependence which saps your confidence.
Well, it's a risk. It's a business risk. And it's also emotional, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really, really good advice, Chris. I'm thinking now about the average small entrepreneur that's just really trying to get going, and you know, they can't even imagine this situation, you know, where they have a client that's giving them so much business. Do you have any advice for people just starting out? You know, should they start out with a special discounted price or something like that? How should they negotiate their way into a market that is filled with people with more experience?
I think the first thing I'd say is think into the future. In a year's time, 2 years' time, as you've built up the business and you've built credibility, what precedents are, there's a danger that we set precedents which then in a year's time, 2 years' time, we regret because we've gone in too low. And think about my price today. Will I still be happy with that in a year's time? Because going back to a client in a year or 2 years' time, as your business becomes more acceptable, to say, I'm increasing my prices by 50%, I think you'll get thrown out by most clients. So it's thinking about, what price do I charge that I will still feel reasonably comfortable with in a year or so's time as the business grows? But at the same time, you need to build some critical mass. You need to build some momentum and volume going through. So it's a real catch 22. I come across too many businesses that have set their price too low, and they find that they've shot themselves in the foot.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we started out very low in both my businesses because we didn't know any better, and I didn't know you. And, you know, we've put the prices up however many times, not once a year, I'm pleased to say, or I shouldn't be pleased to say that, but we've had a number of price increases, but not for the same thing. I think you're constantly looking at and changing the services you offer and you know, the features of those services so that it's not exactly apples to apples. Mm. One of the things that I'm very interested in is having a look at something where the client feels it's bespoke, you've got, or custom, you've got a bit of an idea, the elements that are going into it. It's you haven't got to create everything from scratch, but you've got a starting point, and then you have a few areas where you can have a bit more of this, bit less of that, maybe some bonuses. Is that along the right lines?
I think it is. But be careful about first-time discounts. Something that some clients will say is, look, this is the first time you've worked with us. Offer us a special price on this first job. And I would really discourage anybody doing that, because I think you'll find it very difficult to get back to your preferred price, your proper price, subsequently in the future. If you do want to do discounts, then offer discounts for volume. Mm-hmm. So for me, I won't discount a first workshop, but I might say to the client, look, if you book three of these, four of these over the next year, if you spend a minimum of X, then yes, I will look at a discount, but I won't discount that first one.
Yeah, I'm very pleased to announce that I've got something similar in my business, and I was doing a calculation earlier, and it's actually better value for the client to have me for 5 days than it is for four. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, have I messed that up? And I thought, I'm going to leave it as is for now, because it's attractive. It'll push somebody over the edge. It's just something fun that that we're doing here in Real Thought Leaders. So if we've only got a couple of minutes left, which I know is very sad, but I would like to pick your brains, and I'm sure the listeners really want to hear about your thoughts from the book and how you have been able to parlay that into so much else, especially your articles and your speaking. So one of the topics that comes up a lot here, in terms of reach, which is the first element of Real Thought Leadership, you obviously can extend your reach a lot further when you have these articles and blogs coming out. So do you want to share how you've been able to produce so much stuff?
I think the book gave me credibility then to write articles. So I regularly write articles, probably about 10 or so per year. And I have help with that, getting those published. And that I like to then repurpose the content from those. So I choose very carefully which publications and therefore what audience am I trying to target, and think about what subjects are going to be particularly of interest to the editors. So every quarter I think about some 3-4 different topics that or angles that I think will be relevant to those audiences that I particularly want to target. So I find articles are a great way of adding credibility, and I then reuse those, put those onto my website, maybe send those to clients. I think also one of the things I found having written the book is that it makes you raise your game, and it helps you consolidate your thinking. And because you kind of think, how can I take this even further? So if I'm going to be an expert in subject X, how can I really be the number one expert in the UK or in the US or in Europe on my particular topic? As you used the phrase earlier, being the the leader in one person within your marketplace.
The category of one is what I
category
said.
Of
That's
one,
not my phrase. I don't know where it came from. Someone else said it first.
It's so that clients would be crazy not to use you if that's the particular subject that they want. They'd be mad not to go to you.
Yeah. And you're quite reliable, you know, because we've worked together in a number of situations, speaking situations, and the articles, of course, and the book publishing. So I think it really helps if you commit to doing things like that, that you deliver good material on time. I think you've always said yes when we've had an opportunity, And that's another really helpful hint for people. You're never too busy. You know, lose a half an hour of sleep if you need to, but get the meet those deadlines. So, and you always have.
Another thing that's going through my mind, Mindy, about thought leadership is think about not just round the next bend, but round the next two bends in terms of where are my clients, where's their business going, where's industry going, where's that market sector going, so that you can help them think into the future. Mm-hmm. Wayne Gretzky, who was a Canadian ice hockey player, he was asked, if you ask a Canadian, they'll say he was the greatest ice hockey player ever. He was asked, why are you such a great ice hockey player? And he said, it's not that I know where the puck is, I know where the puck is going to be. And I think each of us in our industry needs to think about not just where is our business and our market, but where's it going to be next year and the year after, and how can I help my clients cope with that future, which is changing so rapidly for most businesses?
Oh, wow. Well, on that note, and this was not planned, can you tell the listeners where your business is going to be in future, where you're heading, and how they can be part of it?
I want to do more conference speaking. Probably 80% of my revenue comes from training workshops, probably about 5% from coaching, and the rest from speaking. I would like to particularly increase the speaking opportunities. I find that such an exciting and challenging opportunity to condense my absolute best stuff into three quarters of an hour or into an hour to really get people changing their behavior. And I think the second area is what I just mentioned, which is helping people change their behavior, because I think it's not the information that we share, it's what our clients and customers then do with it. Because if they sit there and go, that's very interesting, but do nothing with it, then personally, I feel I've failed. It's about what are they going to do differently as a result of hearing me speak or reading an article. That's what I want, is to help them have the confidence to behave differently and to do things differently and more boldly.
Mm. Well, what a great word to end the interview on, boldly, as in 24 karat boldly. Chris Merton, it's been an absolute pleasure interviewing you today. And I'd forgotten some of the gems, so there's always more where that came from. So do seek him out, listeners, Chris Merrington, and his wonderful book on negotiating better profit for yourself and your business. And it's called Why Do Smart People Make Such Stupid Mistakes? Thank you so much for joining us today, Chris.
It's been a pleasure. I wish it could be for longer. Can I mention my website?
Go on then.
www.spring8020.co.uk.
Okay, that will also be in the websites and the social media that we're doing. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye, Mindy. Thank you.
Thank you for joining Mindy and her guests. Please join her again next week, same time and place, for more insights and ideas from real thought leaders.